it's coming from, and I had no idea where you had gone.
How did you get in? Skip said.
I have a key, of course. What sort of a question is that?
He was catching his breath now, his heart trying to slow down from the drive, the bridge, the alarm, and above all from the sight of Mrs. Blessing in the small room. He felt funny, shining the flashlight right at her like that, illuminating all the lines in her face, and the fear in the set of her mouth, and the wild glare in her light eyes.
You have to do something, she said.
I will.
Right this minute. The entire house could be burned to the ground while you fiddle about.
Not in this rain, it won't. There was no smell of fire in the apartment, only the smell of rain and mothballs, maybe from Mrs. Blessing's raincoat, and the smell of powder and the sweet smell of baby wipes that Chris had scented with his nose for secrets and weakness. Skip shone the flashlight onto the face of his watch. It was 20 minutes until 12.
You needn't worry, Mrs. Blessing said sharply. I'll stay here with the child while you see about the alarm and the fire.
What? Skip said.
You can imagine my surprise, she said, her mouth pursed, to come in here looking for help and discover that behind my back, without permission, you had your child living here.
Of course. She'd come over and made a circuit of the place. She owned it, after all, and she owned him, too, in her way. Skip felt his shoulders slump, as though his body knew the sad, pathetic ending to this latest brief episode in his life before his mind did. It was like when the sheriff's car had been waiting behind his truck at McGuire's the night after the Quick Stop robbery. His whole body had gone slack, his eyes sad, in the moment before he had known to say to himself, "Well, that's it, then." Chris would be pleased, he thought, when he heard Skip got fired from Blessings.
Welcome back, he'd say, standing at the bar at McGuire's.
Lose the job. Lose the baby. He guessed he'd wind up leaving her in the hallway at the courthouse for the social workers after all. His stomach turned, the beer gone sour. I was surprised by her, too, he said finally in a tired voice, pointing the beam of the flashlight down at the floor. The room was quiet and the rain slowing, so that the individual raindrops fell on the roof like the sound of a child hammering on one key of a piano, one low note again and again. From their pattern, he could tell that the storm was moving, and that by daybreak the air would be clear. He went down the hall to the hook where he hung the big slicker one of the Fosters had left behind.
Charles,
she called querulously after him, and he stiffened.
What is this baby's name?
She doesn't have a name yet, he said.
That's preposterous. Where's her mother?
She doesn't have a mother either.
It's impossible to imagine how someone could do everything that is needed around here and take care of an infant as well, she said. I would never have hired a man with a small child, she said. Babies are very unpredictable, she said.
Mostly he said nothing. He looked down at the Aubusson rug in the small study and rubbed at a paint spot on his brown work pants. This was the room where Lydia Blessing did what she thought of as business, where she told the carpenter the estimate was too high, complained to Nadine's husband that the heat in the car was still insufficient, paid bills, and wondered aloud why everything cost so much. Her father had done business here as well, with the decanter at his elbow.
Are you absolutely certain? She said. Just placed on the steps like that in a box. Wasn't there any sort of identification or some sort of note?
It's not the kind of thing you'd make a mistake about, ma'am, he said.
It's very difficult to believe that someone would just abandon an infant in the middle of nowhere like that, she said, straightening a stray envelope in one cubby.
It is the ideal place for you to have the baby, her mother had said 60 years before. She put her hand to her forehead. There it was again, the echo, the minuet of words spoken in the present with those from the past. It had gotten worse since she had seen the baby in the yellow glare of the flashlight, sleeping with a fist pressed to its pursed lips. Her mother had been right, of course. In the middle of nowhere had seemed a good place to raise a child during that first year of the war. There were always rumors that bombings would begin in New York, just as they had in London, and the social life of the city was constrained, partly in deference to the war, partly because there were no men around. Of course, the young Lydia had thought it was a temporary measure, and that Blessings would once again become a country retreat when the war was over and real life began. In her mind's eye, she could see the apartment she and Benny would have, the brocade sofa against the long wall of the living room, the barrel-end tables, the painting of a sailing schooner over the mantel. Benny would go downtown to his father's firm, which would someday be his firm, and Lydia would play cards with girls she had once gone to Bertram's with. And their children would go to Bertram's too, or the Thomas Makepeace Vester School for Boys, which was where Benny and Sonny had gone before they had gone away to boarding school. Sonny would come to dinner and make them both laugh, and the children would love him, perhaps as well as, if not better than, they loved their mother and father. It was as though it all really existed. It was all there, all true, as though, as their upper school science teacher had said, Professor Einstein had indeed shown that all time took place simultaneously, only in different locations. In the middle of the night, as Meredith had been mollified by the rubber nipple and the thick, yeasty-smelling formula, as the soft sounds of the outside slipped into the silence of the house, Mrs. Blessing had imagined that in an apartment on Park Avenue, an older, wiser Lydia was going over the menu for a dinner party and telling a room full of overexcited children to go see Nanny, please, and go to the park to play. It was only the moments alone with Benny she could not imagine. What she would say, what he would say, how he would touch her, what it would feel like, whether it would always feel cool and hesitant and smooth when he kissed her. "This is all right, isn't it, Liddy?" he'd whispered at the municipal building after they were married. "This will be good." "A child should have two parents," she said to Skip Cuddy, folding her hands firmly in her lap and looking out over the pond. Still he was silent. Lydia Blessing had known Benny Carton almost her entire life. She had been 5 when he and Sonny became friends at Vester. "You have a sister," Benny had breathed the first time his nanny brought him to the house, and he had reached out a hand to touch a blue ribbon tied around her hair. "You have 2 brothers, Sonny said.
"It's not the same," Benny said. "Is she good?"
"I like her," Sonny had said. That was what she remembered, how happy she had been.
"Sonny likes me, Mama,"
she had said that night at dinner after he'd been sent from the table for making his napkin into a hand puppet and refusing to make the hand puppet be quiet. "Well, he ought to, oughtn't he?" her mother had said. It was odd how important those things were to children. She wondered what she had said casually to Meredith, that she had never given a thought and that Meredith could remember like a motto on a sampler. "Well, he ought to, oughtn't he?" As though Sonny's liking was no more momentous than a napkin on the lap or a fish knife with Dover sole. But it was Sonny's matter-of-fact "I like her" that she would never forget. He and Benny had always been together after that day, although now Benny lay beneath a white stone cross in a small cemetery by the sea in Newport, and Sonny's ashes had been scattered over the pond, a breeze blowing them up and over into the air and then into the green water eddying around the little boat. She closed her eyes at the memory. Skip was still standing silent, and she wanted to make him say something.
"I am far too old to have even collateral responsibility for an infant," she said loudly, in the small dark-paneled room as he picked at the spot on his pants.
"I don't like that guy one little bit," Benny had said when he cut in on her and an older boy from Vester at a club dance. She remembered that, too, and that his hand at the small of her back had perspired, so that when they went onto the terrace that looked out over the children's zoo, she felt a cold place there. "I don't like the way he behaves," Benny had said when they were outside, holding their cigarettes conspicuously, both of them experimental smokers. "I'd rather not be more specific than that." He had leaned over the ornamented limestone balcony, his head tilted to one side. "Listen," he said, "can you hear the monkeys?" She thought she could, a faint hooting sound like the disapproving crowd at a sporting event if you were outside the stadium. Benny smiled. You can hear them from my grand's apartment. When I was little, I thought they were talking. I used to think I could hear whole conversations in monkey talk. What were they saying? Not much. They say a lot of the same things we do, really. Weather, gossip. That's dull, Lydia had said. Even when she was younger, sweeter, more tractable, less deadened by life, she had been what the teachers called blunt. Benny had laughed. He was not much taller than she was, and the way his hair arched back at each corner of his forehead foretold his future baldness. He had black eyes and long lashes, a small thin dash of a mouth bracketed by dimples, like a punctuation mark. That's what she had said on the balcony, and he had laughed again. You're the only girl in the world I like, he'd said. And he'd said it again the day they were married. He was still a little drunk that morning from the night before, and he sucked on peppermints so the clerk wouldn't notice, although they overlooked a lot in the City Hall chapel in those days, especially if the groom was in uniform. 3 days later, he was sent south to a base in Georgia, and then quickly overseas to Europe. His letters suggested cryptically that his facility with languages would keep him out of harm's way. Her mother sent Lydia to the country to do the same for her, or so she said. It's been 60 years since there's been a baby in this house, Lydia Blessing said. She had gotten the telegram telling her Benny was dead on the day that Meredith took her first step, lurching from the ottoman to the end table in the den. Benny's father sent a car to bring her to the memorial service at St. Stephen's, and afterward he took her into the library of the big apartment on Fifth Avenue and asked if Meredith could come to them in Newport for a month of every summer. All three of the Carton boys were dead, one of scarlet fever, another in the war 2 weeks before his brother. Only Benny had had time to marry. Please say yes, Mrs. Carton had murmured in the foyer. Or more often, if you'd like. It's a good opportunity for Meredith, Ethel Blessing had said when her parents came out to the house for the weekend. Cherchez l'argent, Lydia had said bitterly. But Ethel Blessing, who had not gone to Bertram's, like so many of Lydia's friends' mothers had, but instead had been taught at home by a nanny who spoke bad French with a German accent, said only, They have a lovely home. They are nice people. As though the two were one and the same, 18 rooms equaling excellent character. Lydia had stayed on in the country house for a while, thinking it was easier to have this interlude, with Mrs. Foster cooking and the baby nurse taking care of Meredith. It was difficult for her to imagine how she would manage to greet Frank Askew when she got back to the city, how she could affect the even, uninterested gaze, and the cool, polite platitudes a girl was expected to use when she spoke to the fathers of her friends. It was difficult to imagine meeting his wife and daughters in Central Park with Meredith, and watching their eyes light on the small face with swiftly veiled recognition. It made it easier when she remembered that the nannies usually took the children to the park, that in their heavy prams, in their embroidered caps, the babies all looked the same, as if they could be anyone's. She spent hazy summer mornings walking around the pond, weeping, thinking about finding a place to live in New York, and when it would be decent for her to return. She wept for her husband, not because she had not married him for love, but because, had he lived, she would have had to pretend she had until enough time had passed for them to settle into the passive give and take of the not unfriendly society pair. Each afternoon she took her baby with her in the boat, rowing from one end of the pond to another, while the nurse stood on the high ground by the dock, frowning down at her muddy shoes. The boat still lay by the pond, shining white. She remembered that Charles had painted it the week before, and remembering, she had a picture in her mind of him, stoop-shouldered and furtive, and understood that he had been carrying the child with him everywhere for days. I can't imagine what sort of a person would abandon a child in this fashion, she said. 2 months before Benny died, she had received the longest of his letters. It was clear from the scribbling on the envelope and a variety of official stamps that it had gone badly astray after it was mailed. His handwriting was difficult to read, the left-handed scrawl of a haphazard student. She had waited until she was 7 months pregnant to write to him about the baby. They had spent 3 nights in a small hotel on Gramercy Park, and on none of them had he been able to make love to her in the usual way. His ways were Benny's ways, she supposed at the time, gentle, tentative, generous, a little boyish, as though they were in the back closet at dancing class. The sight of his handwriting on the letter had made her fearful, but there was nothing to fear. "Dear Liddy," he had scrawled, "I am really happy about the baby. I hope it will be a girl, and that she will look exactly like you. The happiest thought I have here is that someday I will come home, and you will be there, and the baby will be there, and it will be like a regular, ordinary family, and all this will be like a bad dream. When I keep that in my mind, I am all right. Love, Benny. Your husband." It was as though with the parenthetical expression he was trying to convince or remind himself, and her. He had always loved babies, Benny had. He was the sort of boy who would help a pair of toddlers build with blocks at a birthday party while the other older boys were ripping up the drawing room and throwing cake. He was the sort of man who would have spent endless hours pushing a child on the swings in Central Park. She had been able to see him in her mind, singing nonsense songs, pushing a pram through the park paths while the nanny clucked disapproval. "Mr. Carton, sir," she would say. "Mr. Carton, that's my job." That stayed with her for years, that sketch drawn in a few simple sentences, that idea of a parallel life that might have been hers, with Benny in a Chesterfield chair, losing his hair little by little, and Meredith growing every day more like her mother, or even like Benny, instead of more like Frank Askew. A week after she'd learned that Benny was dead, an enormous box had arrived from the stationers on Madison Avenue, and when she opened it, she found box after box of ecru-colored cards. "Mrs. J. Bennett Carton" was engraved at the top of each one in faint script, the color of coffee with cream. "Blessings, Mount Mason." There was stationery enough to last for years. It had been a winter day, snow thick upon the roof and trees, and in the silence broken only by the sound of logs spitting sap from the living room fireplace. Lydia had looked at the cards and understood then, as surely as if they were legal documents. Her mother had decided that Lydia was to live in exile at Blessings, never again to sleep lulled by the sounds of cars struggling by in the morass of the streets of the east side of Manhattan. She knew. Lydia did not know how, but her mother knew. The sin Lydia Blessing thought she'd hidden so neatly was known to some and had to be kept secret from all the rest. She threw one of the boxes of stationery into the fire, then another, until the flames reached out with blue and orange claws, burned Lydia's right hand, blistered and blackened the paint of the mantelpiece. "I'm happy you've made up your mind to stay," Mrs. Foster said when Lydia told her she would remain at Blessings for a while. "The city is no place to bring up a child." Lydia's younger self had punished her mother by exiling her, too, at least in effigy, by banishing all the customs and ceremonies that Ethel Blessing had held so dear at Blessings. Since she had never thought of herself as anyone but Lydia Blessing, she ordered her own stationery with her own name on it in a fit of defiance that surprised even her when the cards and envelopes finally arrived. Just as she had burned some of the cards her mother had sent and put the rest away in the garage attic, so she buried the formalities that had defined the lives of her mother and her mother's friends. For a time, life at Blessings was irregular. Sandwiches slapped together by other young widows who came for the weekend and ate at odd hours, swimming in their underwear with men who played at being interested in women. White circles from drink glasses on bedside tables, a martini shaker always in the bar refrigerator, the faint creak of bedroom doors opening and closing in the middle of the night. But the customs of slight degeneracy had become customs, nonetheless. And after a time, the swims became tedious, and sometimes dangerous for the guests who were really drunk, and everyone began to want better meals. And before she knew it, Lydia's life, too, had become a series of small ceremonies. The house parties became one or two long-married couples staying the weekend, and the gossip was about their children and their children's friends instead of one another. There was tennis in the morning, croquet in the late afternoon, and Sunday brunch of Bloody Marys and omelets filled with herbs from the garden in summer, or cheese from the farmer who raised goats down the road in winter. During the week, she played golf every Wednesday, followed by a swim and tennis with her best friend, Jess. "This is my birthday wish," Jess had said when she was turning 30, a month after Lydia had done so. "I want you to meet someone nice and marry again and have 3 more children who will play with my children, and when we're old, we'll sit by your pond and talk about old times and watch our grandchildren swim the way we swam." But none of it had turned out as Jess had wanted. Her children had come by with their mother to swim in the pond with Meredith, but there had been no husband for Lydia, and so no more children, and it had become clear over time that there would be no grandchildren either. Jess had not gotten old. She had gotten sick. Lydia had spent hours sitting next to her bed and holding her hand, and Jessie had cried, "God damn it, I feel gypped." And Lydia had felt gypped too. She did not care to play golf or tennis after that, and soon she could no longer swing a club, what with the arthritis in her hands and shoulders. And the weekends with house guests had given way to the occasional visit from Meredith and her husband, the occasional lunch with her lawyer, the occasional dinner with Jess's daughter Jean and her husband Ed. One set of rituals had given way to another as summer gave way to fall, not through choice, but through inevitable custom. Sometimes she thought of Benny in his leather chair, reading the papers, losing his hair. But more often she thought of him as a boy listening to the monkeys talk, his head to one side, trying to figure out what the monkeys were saying. She thought of him and Meredith rowing across the pond, laughing. She sighed. Thinking of the monkeys had made her sad, and her voice soft. "Charles," she said, "now that I am aware of this peculiar chain of events, at the very least you could bring her outside. Keeping her perpetually indoors can't be healthy." And finally he spoke, perhaps because the frost had melted from her voice. "I can't be out with her, ma'am," he said. "If Nadine sees her, she'll tell Mr. Foster, and he'll tell some of the guys he works with, and they'll tell their wives, and then people will say I stole her or she belongs to some girl in town that I was, I guess you'd say, fooling around with. And then there'll be all these rumors, and they'll send somebody official to see me, and there'll be this whole big mess, and who knows what might happen." "Oh, nonsense. Who cares about one baby?" And all the voices of the past came back to remind her in a great chorus. Frank, her mother, Benny, her father, even Meredith, that one baby could change everything. "You don't really understand the way things are around here." "Nonsense. I've lived in Mount Mason since long before you were born." "No, ma'am, you live at Blessings. That's totally different." He looked toward the kitchen. "Like, here's an example. You bought the kitchen table from Harrison's furniture store around 15 years ago. You got it on sale. I think maybe it was about $200, is that right?" Mrs. Blessing nodded grudgingly. "See, my dad is a long-distance trucker, but sometimes to make extra money, he used to do deliveries around town. He delivered this table. And Mr. Harrison told him you bought the cheapest piece in the showroom. And my dad told all his friends at the bar that you didn't tip him, and when he asked for a drink of water, you sent him to the pump." Mrs. Blessing's lips were pressed tightly together. "What does that have to do with what we are discussing, Charles? Everybody knows everything about everybody around here. And one of the things they know is that your family is better off than anyone else in the valley. So let's say some girl has a baby, and she figures she has zero money or no good place to live or whatever. Maybe she's one of those big fat girls you hear about on the news who gets pregnant and no one even figures it out, just thinks it's too many quarter pounders or something. She might think if she has the baby in the bathroom and then leaves it here, it will have this great life. Tennis in the morning, croquet in the afternoon, a housekeeper, a pond, a rumored pile of money." She realized he must be right. Still, she said, "Charles, I'm 80 years old. My daughter, who never had children of her own, is now 60. No reasonable person could imagine this family could care for a child." People think all kinds of things about this place. But then someone who thought they'd give a baby to rich people is at the Walmart or the drugstore and hears that I'm walking around with this baby. And now, instead of the baby getting to live at Blessings, the baby gets to live over the garage, which maybe isn't any better than where the mother was living herself. I beg your pardon. The Fosters found that a perfectly fine place to raise three children. They never complained. No, ma'am, I bet they didn't. She should have called him in and fired him. That was what she had intended when she had had Nadine fetch him from the woodshed. She did not know why she hadn't. It was so difficult to find decent help. And the baby had slept all the time she had waited for him during that terrible storm, while he reset the alarm and checked that the smoldering corner of the barn roof was not going to spread with a heavy July rain. I've been working with her in a front pack for 2 weeks now, Skip said, talking fast. It doesn't work all the time, but it works most of the time, and I've got her on a pretty good schedule now. I have to keep her a secret for now, and this is a really good place to do that. Mrs. Blessing sat up straight. I have to give this some thought, she said. In the meantime, the split-rail fencing on the south side of the drive appears to be leaning. Is there anything we can do short of replacing the fence? There was that crooked smile again. I already ordered some steel supports to hammer in behind the uprights, he said. I'll tie them together and we'll get at least another couple years out of that section. And the child? I'll put her in the front pack. You could leave her over here from time to time. There is a back bedroom with a cradle. I can't take the chance with Nadine, he said. Besides, she should really stay at my place. She's my baby. A child needs a name, Charles. I'm working on it, he said. I figure most people get 9 months to figure that out. Besides, until now I wasn't sure I could still keep her. I just couldn't stand to name her if I couldn't keep her. Later, as Mrs. Blessing ate her dinner at the table by the window, the sun melting orange into the pond, she remembered there was a bear somewhere upstairs, sitting on an old chair in a back bedroom that was used for children who came to visit, although none had come in years. It had been Benny's bear when he was small. Its fur was rubbed thin on the stomach and pate, and it was stuffed with something that made it hard and not huggable. 5-year-old Meredith had been clutching it one morning after she'd been driven all night in the Cartons' big car from Newport. Mrs. Foster had made her a cup of cocoa and some muffins. Sonny had been there too, staying in his old room, and he had heard the car arrive and had come downstairs in a big plaid bathrobe, his golden hair every which way. Was my daddy a good daddy? Meredith had asked Lydia. And Mrs. Foster had paused just a moment as she spooned fresh whipped cream into the cocoa. Lydia had been trying to think of what to say when Sonny dropped down next to the little girl and put his face up close to hers. Benny Carton was the best daddy in the whole wide world, he said, and held her tight. Lydia had gone upstairs and wept. She did not know it, but that was what Meredith would always remember, that she had peeked into the bedroom and seen her stern and undemonstrative mother crying. And for the rest of her life, even when she was a grown woman, she would recall that moment and feel as though her childhood had held something sweet and deep. She had not known, of course, that Lydia Blessing wept for herself and for her own lost life and for something in Sonny's voice that she had never heard before. Lydia had not known it either. Slowly she rose from her desk chair and went upstairs, down the hallway of closed bedroom doors, to find the bear. Nadine's daughter, Jennifer, walked across the lawn with the muscles in the front of her thighs rolling beneath the skin. She was built like a swimmer, which was what she'd been at Mount Mason High School. Her hair was black and hung halfway down her back in a loose ponytail. Skip tried not to look at her too long. At his feet, the tangle of willow roots splayed into the pond, and two large-mouthed bass fluttered their fins and seemed to stare up at him. Back in the blackberry bramble behind him was a basket with a baby asleep inside. There hadn't been rain for 2 weeks since the storm on the 4th of July, and he could hear the grass crunching as Jennifer Foster walked. Skip tried to sniff himself without raising his arms. Not too bad. although he thought maybe the smell of diesel fuel from the chainsaw was mixed with the smell of Desitin from the baby, who had some kind of rash. Maybe Jennifer Foster didn't know what Desitin smelled like. It actually smelled a little like diesel fuel.
"Hello," she said. "I'm sorry to bother you."
She had a funny way of talking, as though she were older than she was. She didn't bother to say her name, and he didn't bother to say his. Nobody in Mount Mason was ever introduced to anyone else. Skip knew that her father had been in some peacekeeping force in Korea and had married Nadine there and brought his wife and kid over when he could finally manage to get them out. Skip knew that Craig Foster didn't speak to most of his family because one of his uncles had said at a Memorial Day barbecue that Craig was sleeping with the enemy, and most all of the other Fosters had sided with the uncle, who they said didn't mean any harm, and how come Nadine had to be such a bitch anyhow? Skip knew that Jennifer worked part-time at the hospital and went to nursing school at the community college, which surprised him a little, since she seemed like the kind of girl who could go to state, maybe even someplace better. Skip knew that she'd never had a serious boyfriend, and that made the mothers of Mount Mason pretty happy because, as well-mannered and pretty as she still wasn't white. She was more or less tan. In every way, she was the opposite of most of the other girls he knew in Mount Mason, who got out of high school, got pregnant, and got fat.
"Come right back,"
Nadine called from the kitchen window, all the consonants flat in that funny way she had of talking, like a person who was deaf. Jennifer Foster didn't roll her eyes exactly, but she raised her brows a little bit. She probably knew that Skip's mother was dead. She probably knew that in high school he'd lived in one of those listing frame houses with the narrow front porches on Front Street with his aunt and uncle, instead of in one of the brick ranches tented over by trees out in the valley with parents like she had. And she definitely knew, by the way she was smiling so nicely, but with a little bit of an edge in her eyes, about the stretch in the county jail.
"She want you!" Nadine shouted.
"First, she sends me out here to give you some message about the barn, then she yells at me to come back." Jennifer Foster shook her head, then looked up. "Isn't this a great tree? When I was a little girl, I used to sit under it and read. If it rains, you don't even get wet, unless it's pouring." "You have to keep after it," Skip said, putting the pruners down in the wheelbarrow. "The branches get too long, and then some of them aren't really as strong as they need to be, and they can come down pretty hard if there's a storm and take the healthy ones with them." She's sort of letting him go. "Mrs. Blessing, I mean." Jennifer Foster smiled. "I know who she refers to around here," she said. It was hard to believe, looking at her, that Jennifer Foster was Nadine and Craig Foster's daughter. Together, the parents looked like a sight gag. Craig was a huge man with narrow shoulders, a high, pale forehead, brown hair fading to gray, and a mustache that somehow made him look silly, almost as though it were fake. Nadine was something else. She had the small and sexless body of a young boy, her legs slightly bowed, her arms muscled and bowed too. Her face was flat with an ugly, mysterious scar across one cheek, part cut, part burn. All the times he'd seen her, Skip had never seen her hair any way but pulled tightly back into a ponytail, had never seen her wear anything but jeans and a man's shirt. The only jewelry she wore was a digital watch that beeped every 15 minutes and a wedding ring. "Be like beating your meat against a board," Chris had said once when they'd seen the Fosters in town together. It was cruel even to picture Jennifer with the two of them. He couldn't understand how two people who looked like that had produced one who looked like this. "Mongrels, Skippy," Chris had said. "They make the best dogs." Chris always had a mean mouth on him. One night in McGuire's, he'd bought Shelley a beer, when Skip had just started dating her, if you could call it dating, getting drunk with someone in a bar, going home with them, then sleeping it off. And Chris said, "Shelley, your tits wouldn't be so big if you weren't so fat." Skip waited for Shelley to throw her beer in his face, which would have at least made Chris respect her. But instead, she ran into the ladies' room and cried. Skip went home alone that night. Sometimes he wondered if it was Chris who had knocked Shelley up. Chris loved sleeping with girls he hated. Nadine was marching across the driveway turnaround carrying a red and white striped dish towel like a flag, or a weapon, maybe, like she was going to flog them with it.
"You deaf?"
she said.
"I'm coming." She want to see you, Nadine said to Jennifer, and then she turned and looked at Skip, narrowing her eyes that were already slits in her small, flat face. She had the gift, or in her case, the curse, of making you see yourself as she saw you. Skip could imagine the circles of sweat on his gray T-shirt, the dirt that must be smudged on his face, the grease on his hands.
She want to see you, too. She say you go to garage, take things back there, straighten up, come see her.
Why?
Don't ask me, Nadine said, waving the dish towel, heading back toward the house.
I imagine you know who she is, too, Jennifer Foster said. He sure did. He and she had become part of a conspiracy. The instructions Mrs. Blessing had given Nadine meant that she was watching with her little birding binoculars and knew he was out with the baby, that he should settle her into the apartment before he came over to the big house. 2 days before, a woman delivering some slipcovers that had been cleaned had come from town unexpectedly while Skip was working on the fences with the baby in the basket at his feet, and he had been flabbergasted by the sight of Mrs. Blessing waving him away from the house from a second-story window, her flowered scarf a bright flag of caution in her hand.
Charles, she had said the night before, if you must go to town, you must leave her here with me. You can wait until Nadine has left for the day.
What will you do if she wakes up hungry? He said.
For pity's sake, I've had a child of my own, she said.
But something in her pinched face told him she was wondering the same thing. He looked closely at all the windows facing the pond and then put the basket in the wheelbarrow. The baby was awake, staring at the sky and trying to cram her fist into her mouth. There was a star-shaped swirl of hair at the crown of her head, of which he was oddly proud, and her pointed tongue moved between her lips, as though she were tasting the air. She had a scratch down one cheek from her sharp little nails, and Skip knew that Mrs. Blessing would have something to say about that, although he'd just trimmed the nails himself, an operation that made him so nervous he'd had to start and stop a couple of times. Skip never knew how to put her down to sleep, either. He had one book that said on the back so she wouldn't die of crib death, and another that he'd gotten at a yard sale for a quarter that said on the stomach so she wouldn't die inhaling her own vomit. He'd decided to alternate, although sometimes he forgot what he'd done the night or the nap before. Reading the books had made him wonder how anyone came out of infancy alive, or fatherhood. They'd had one more bad night when she wouldn't sleep and wouldn't eat and never wanted to be put down for even a minute. Her head lurched from side to side on her thin stem of a neck, and she stopped crying only to suck noisily on the shoulder of his shirt, then on his nose. Luckily, it had been a Sunday, and he hadn't missed any work, but he'd had to put her on the day bed in the back room again and walk away to get his bearings. "Let her cry it out," Mrs. Blessing had said when he made the mistake of mentioning it the next day. "That was the belief when my daughter was small. Otherwise, they'll be terribly spoiled." Skip hadn't said anything. He thought everybody needed a little bit of spoiling, particularly when they were no bigger than a groundhog. He looked down at her sleeping, and he filled up with the simple fact of her, that she was alive and breathing and getting bigger day by day, with nothing and no one but Skip Cuddy to care for her. Sometimes she seemed as though she was trying hard to see him, although the book said she couldn't really focus her eyes yet. In the evening, he would take her outside for an hour or two, take her to the far end of the pond and lay her down on a blanket folded double so the damp earth wouldn't touch her romper.
"Charles," Mrs. Blessing complained, "it's far too damp down there. Bring her up closer to the house."
But sometimes he just wanted to have her all to himself. The bats would make loop-the-loops above them, and the birds would trill to one another, hidden away in the top branches of the darkened trees. He wished he could bring her out into the sunshine more instead of keeping her curled up in the chest carrier so much. The book said sunshine was good for newborns. His next day off, he'd drive somewhere far away, a half an hour or so, and find a park and push her around in the stroller. If anybody asked, he'd say he was her father. He'd actually practiced in front of the mirror. "I'm her father," he'd say. "4 weeks. Yep, a girl. Oh, about 10 pounds. Good baby, sure, really good baby."
He'd looked pretty good until he remembered he was alone and felt like a moron. When he'd given her a bottle, put her down on her side in her porta-crib, and put on a clean shirt, he knocked at Mrs. Blessing's back door. Nadine brought him to the living room. It reminded him of a class trip he'd gone on in sixth grade to George Washington's home at Mount Vernon. There was a big oil portrait of a man over the stone fireplace, and some watercolors of flowers on the far wall. Mrs. Blessing was sitting in a wing chair between the fireplace and the window, her binoculars on the pie-crust table next to her. A teacup was there, too, and a newspaper with a magnifying glass atop it. She was wearing what she usually wore, a white blouse and a long blue skirt. In the light from the window, he could see her scalp through the thin waves of her silver hair. Jennifer was sitting at the piano. It looked like no one ever sat on the living room furniture, except for Mrs. Blessing. "Nonsense," Mrs. Blessing was saying to Jennifer. Skip had noticed that it was one of her favorite words. "Well, it's only my first year," Jennifer said. "At the end of next year, maybe I'll have a better idea of what to do."
"You should be at a fine four-year college," Mrs. Blessing said. "One of the Seven Sisters, perhaps."
"People mind their business," Nadine muttered behind him, but loud enough so that the woman and the girl turned and saw him.
"Charles," said Mrs. Blessing, "this is Jennifer Foster, Nadine's daughter. I trust her implicitly."
She laid a hand on Jennifer's shoulder, the white thrown into relief by the golden skin of the girl. The bones of Mrs. Blessing's hands were articulated, each one clear through the spotted skin, as though she were being whittled down by the constant pressure of the years. It was one of the first things Skip had noticed about her, that, and the fact that the only jewelry she wore was a wedding band. On the pie-crust table was an old black-and-white studio photograph of a young woman in a white dress. He could see that as a girl, Mrs. Blessing had not been girlish. Straight nose and mouth, large eyes and forehead, nothing rounded or soft, as though she had been designed specifically to age gracefully.
"We know each other already," Jennifer said. "We knew each other at school, except for the Charles part."
"It's Skip," Skip said, feeling the heat in his face.
"Charles, before it slips my mind," said Mrs. Blessing, "I am unhappy about what you're doing to that willow tree. There's no need for you to prune that. That tree has a particular shape. It's not like a maple or an elm. The weight of a willow tree goes down, not up. I would like to look at that tree before you do any more work on it. My father planted those trees. They are not replaceable."
"Yes, ma'am, but you better look at it soon. Half the branches on that tree are dead wood. There's all this poison ivy vine that's wrapped itself around the dead branches that you can't see from here with the binoculars. The woodpeckers are having a field day, and if we have a good-sized storm anytime soon, which we will have since it's July, it just might take off the good wood with the rotten stuff. That's what happened during the July 4th storm. If it happens again, your father's whole tree will wind up in the pond, and I'll be pulling it out with chains and the tractor." Skip could feel Jennifer Foster watching him. He loved that tree, too.
"That tree has done fine without you for 60-odd years, Charles," Mrs. Blessing said.
"Yes, ma'am.
And it will be fine for 60 more."
"No, ma'am, it won't. I called the county extension service, and they said that by rights I should prune a third of the small limbs on that tree every year. And there's one more thing. There's a repair that needs to be made to the roof of the barn right near the door to the hayloft. It's that place where the lightning hit during the storm. It has..." Mrs. Blessing got to her feet. When she moved, her clothes gave off a sharp, powdery scent, like the lavender in the beds by the boathouse.
"Take care of it," she said, moving toward the piano and riffling through the sheet music on its stand.
"I think it's probably too big a job for me. Someone was shooting off a gun in there, maybe shooting pigeons or wood doves, and then the rain made..."
She did not stop or turn back toward him, and there was a certain grave dignity to the precision of her slow and labored movements. Skip suddenly realized, looking at her curved back, that when she was younger, she must have been a tall woman, nearly as tall as he was.
"Have it taken care of," she said.
Jennifer Foster followed him outside and across the driveway turnaround.
She stopped by her little blue car. A straw handbag was on the seat and a pair of sunglasses. There was a stuffed panda on the dash wearing a little shirt that said, Number One Daughter. Skip figured it had come from her father.
It sounds as if you can cut back the willow tree, she said. If she doesn't object outright, then it means she agrees.
If she really objects, you'd know about it. You translating?
Yeah, I guess so,
Jennifer said, smiling. I've known her a long time. I remember I wanted to cut my hair in sixth grade. She said, I won't hear of it. And when I said I was going to Mason County Community, you should have heard her. She wanted you to go to state.
She wanted me to go to Wellesley or Smith.
Never heard of them, Skip said.
Waiting,
Nadine screeched from the kitchen window.
Sorry,
Jennifer said. I have to go back in and play the piano. She says it saves on tuning. She smiled again and squinted up at him in the sun.
You should just fix the barn. You don't even have to ask her about the barn when there's a problem.
How long have you known her? Skip asked.
For as long as I've been in Mount Mason, she replied.
She had my mother bring me over in the beginning to satisfy her curiosity, I think. And then she wanted to make sure that I wasn't being allowed to speak Korean at home.
Americans should be American. That's what she always says.
She obviously doesn't know my mother. My mother wouldn't let me speak Korean on the plane, much less in Mount Mason. So you think of her as like a grandmother?
Not exactly. It sounds weird, but I think we're friends.
She started out wanting to arrange my life the way she arranges everything around here, you know. She still tries to do some of that. But then I think she got to like me.
She must like you.
Why? She lets you in the house. I'm not even sure the Fosters were ever allowed in the house, except to serve meals or lay the fires in the fireplace. She's funny that way. And since you've been here, she's seemed livelier, I guess I'd say. More tuned in than she has been. I'm not sure she likes me. I think she thinks I do a good job. With her, it comes to the same thing. You should just fix the roof. It'll be fine. The thing is, I can't do it myself. It'll take a professional roofer. You need special ladders and scaffolds. It's not a one-person job.
Then you should hire a roofer. She'll complain, but she'll pay for it.
She never goes down to the barn, but she likes it kept up. Her father had it built for the cows, and her daughter used to stable her horses there.
It seems like a waste. Nobody uses it.
She doesn't care. She just wants it kept up. Her brother died down there. There's a stone right where there's that big clump of lilac bushes. When they're in bloom, I always cut her a big bouquet. The first time I ever came in the living room was to put the vase on the table. I didn't know you were allowed to just bury people on your property.
I'm not sure he's buried there. Anyhow, Mrs. Blessing is allowed to do whatever she pleases. My father says she can make straw into gold and water into wine, like Grimm's fairy tales or the Bible.
Do you really think that's true? Not the straw, but that she can do what she wants and get away with it? Jennifer Foster shrugged.
The point is, if she needs something done, she can find a way to get it done. And she wants you to find a way to get it done, too.
I get that, he said. I meant to say before, your car is idling low. I could tune it the next time you're here, if you want. If you want, I mean.
Thanks, she said, in the voice girls like her always used for guys like him at school. My father owns a garage, so he usually does it.
Oh, yeah, I knew that, stupid.
No, thanks, really.
There was a spear of silver from the porch window.
Don't look now, but she's watching us.
Did you cut your hair in sixth grade? He said.
Are you kidding?
Of course not.
With a faint sense of irritation, Mrs. Blessing realized that someone had invented many things that made having a baby infinitely easier than when she'd had a baby herself. Instead of the ungainly pram with its big stiff wheels, there was this sling contraption that allowed a person to carry an infant around everywhere, hands-free. Instead of the papers of enormous safety pins with Bakelite heads of pink or blue, there were these tapes to hold the paper diapers fast, printed with little dancing characters of some kind. Even the bottles were different. The nipple squared off, the inside lined with plastic bags. It reinforced her feeling that the young women of today had it easier than she had. On the other hand, she was rather proud of her pink keep-safe baby monitor. Skip had handed it over with an air of resignation, the compromise between leaving the baby alone and letting her sleep in the big house when he was out and about. "You can hear every noise she makes," he had said, "but don't overreact. Sometimes she'll just make a little sound and then go back to sleep." Mrs. Blessing switched the monitor on. "I don't hear a thing," she said.
"Listen real carefully," he said.
She pressed the receiver to her ear. In response, she could hear faintly the sound of shallow breathing, in and out, in and out.
"That's her," Skip had said proudly.
Shyly, he added,
"Her name is Faith."
Mrs. Blessing pursed her lips.
"I like it," he added.
"It's not one of those made-up names that everybody has nowadays, like Summer or Whitney or whatever."
"There are children named Summer?"
He nodded. "There's a guy I know, his girlfriend had twins, Summer and Autumn."
"Dear Lord," Mrs. Blessing had said. It was the closest she ever came to profanity.
"What about Faith?"
"I'm sure it will do nicely," she said.
"It just came to me," he said. He had had to go out as soon as Nadine pulled away to try to get to the motor vehicle office before it closed, to register Mrs. Blessing's Cadillac. "She just got fed and changed," he had said through the screen door to the living room. "She should sleep until I get back. Can you hear her?" Mrs. Blessing held the monitor to her ear.
"Perfectly well," she said.
10 minutes after he pulled out, she heard a faint snort and convinced herself that it was her responsibility to check on the child. It was an effort for her to climb the steps to the apartment, and when she arrived at the top, she was perspiring and her shoulder ached. She realized that the other sound she heard on the monitor was the sound of the fans going. Perhaps she should buy an air conditioner for the apartment. Then she snorted herself. Another indulgence for an indulged age. She remembered how the baby nurse had given Meredith cool sponge baths on July days like this one. The baby had splashed spastically, sneezing when the water got into her eyes. Lydia had been afraid always that her child would slip beneath the surface and drown. This baby looked sturdier somehow. The deep pleat in the fat at her elbow made her arms look muscled. Her mouth moved in a sucking motion. She was in the small vinyl porta-crib Skip had unloaded from the truck, along with a swing and a car seat. "I always wondered who shopped at garage sales," he'd said. "Now I know. I got all this great stuff for $10. Mrs. Blessing liked economy, particularly in those who couldn't afford to be profligate. But something sad stirred within her at the sight of the baby, who was becoming quite pretty in that puffy pink baby fashion, in the slightly shabby, slightly faded pastel print of the folding crib, a crib some other child had used when it was new. She laid her hand, which always trembled slightly now, atop the head, and felt her fingers mold themselves automatically to the small skull. It was her favorite part of an infant because it seemed strongest, not as vulnerable as the wobbly trunk or flailing arms. There was a small mobile of mice hanging, grinning from colored umbrellas. When she took her hand away, she knocked it, and the first three notes of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star were sharp in the quiet half-darkness. The baby stirred, moved her head to the side, and brought a fist to her slack mouth. When Mrs. Blessing went back to the house, she felt worn out, and as she breathed in concert with the breathing on the monitor, she felt herself slip away and begin to doze. When the telephone rang, she came awake, terrified as though it were the security alarm again, but it was only Meredith, who made it a habit to call on Wednesdays just before dinner. "How are you feeling, Mother?" she always said now instead of a simple hello.
"I'm fine. Were you sleeping?"
"Of course not. Why in the world would I be sleeping? It isn't 6 yet."
"How are the flowers?"
"About as well as can be expected in this heat. This new man takes good care, but the bugs have made a hash of the nasturtiums, and the lupines are terribly thin."
"I'm so sorry," Meredith said. "How is Nadine?"
"Don't get me started on Nadine. If it were possible to find decent help, she'd be in Mount Mason looking for a job."
"I'm so sorry," Meredith said again by rote, her voice breathy with boredom and impatience.
Two women long past their prime, talking about nothing, Mrs. Blessing thought. That's what she and her daughter had become. Mrs. Blessing wondered what Meredith would say if she told her about the baby in the box, and realized that she had no earthly idea, which seemed terrible. She should know her daughter better, and she knew that this must be at least partly her fault. The baby nurse, the nanny, the summers in Newport, the boarding schools. Meredith had made an early marriage and moved to the horse farm in Virginia, which she'd bought with the proceeds from the sale of the Carton grandparents' house. The result was that they did not know each other very well. Mother and daughter had always to become reacquainted, like people who met from time to time at the same parties. When she was younger, Meredith had tried to talk to her sometimes when they were riding together, after school, before dinner, playing 20 questions to try to measure her young self and puzzle out what she was made of. What was your favorite food when you were my age, Mother? How many girls were in your class at Bertram's? Tell me again about the time you and Uncle Sammy tobogganed onto the pond and broke through the ice. Tell me again about the party Nana and Papa had when you were coming out. Lydia Blessing had felt rather smug that at least she answered her daughter's questions, not like her own mother, who often just had said, "Curiosity killed the cat." "How is your leg feeling?" Meredith said now. When she had opened her eyes in the hospital 2 years ago, she had been dreaming about that coming out party. Or perhaps dreaming was not what it was called when you had had a stroke. In the dream, she had been in the library of a club on Park Avenue. She was wearing a white file dress that fell off her shoulders in big stiff pleats. The room was not very crowded. Many of the guests her mother had invited had had other parties that evening, or at least that was what her mother had said. Across the room, Lydia saw Frank Askew, whose daughter had been 2 years behind her at Bertram's. He had a mustache and a widow's peak. It had all been much as she remembered it, except that in the dream he had come across the room to talk to her, which hadn't happened until a drinks party several months later, and he had bent and kissed her neck, the mustache tickling, which had happened some weeks after the drinks party, in a stuffy back bedroom at the Askews' apartment that smelled of Shalimar and laundry soap and lemon wax. In the dream, she had wanted to turn and walk away, and yet had been unable to do so, as she had been unable to do so in life all those years ago. She had been paralyzed and aroused, too, as she had been in life. Except that when she had looked down at Frank's brilliantined red neck, bent to the curve of her shoulder, she had seen above the low neckline of the white dress the blue veins, the ropey muscles, the semaphore of brown cast across the skin, and realized that it was her old and not her younger self that he was kissing in the dream. Then everything had gone.